Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view, the people who work in the prison system would have another, and I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick, and check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere, every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time Show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. And a warning that this episode of Doin' Time contains audio descriptions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died and graphic discussion of deaths in custody and massacres. On this week's Doin' Time show, we will bring you an interview with Uncle Kelvin from the Myall Creek Committee, who will give us an update of this year's commemoration of the Myall Creek Massacre in the lead up to the memorial in June. And of course, I always love hearing from Uncle and yarning with him about what he's been doing. Then we will hear from Laura John, Associate Legal Director working on migration justice at the Human Rights Law Centre, who will update us on the Senate inquiry, which hears renewed calls to dismantle offshore processing following evidence of abuse and corruption. Then we will interview People with Disability Australia, Acting CEO Megan Spindler-Smith, who will discuss PWDA's backing the Human Rights Commission President's call for a National Human Rights Act. I look forward to speaking to Megan about People with Disability Australia, who is the national advocacy and representative organisation led by and for people with disability, and the president of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Hugh de Kretner, calls for a Human Rights Act made in an address to the National Press Club. But first, I'm delighted to welcome Uncle Kelvin to the program. Hi, Uncle.
Good to hear your voice again, too.
You too. It's so lovely to have you. Now, Uncle Kelvin, what's been going on? Because I know there's several things happening, but I know also, before we get on to other updates, that there is a lead up now to June, isn't there? It's that time of year, again, with the Myall Creek commemoration. And I'm just conscious of the fact that there maybe have been new listeners that have tuned in, particularly people in prison and, you know, First Nations communities as well. Can you just give listeners a little bit of background about Myall Creek?
Okay, as you've already highlighted, that we are talking about the death of that people.
Hey, Uncle, your audio's backing out. Can you kind of go into a new position?
Can you hear me now?
That's it. Oh, beautiful.
No worries. Okay, no worries. It's just
what I saw
on the phone, actually.
Awesome.
Okay, look, I don't like to sort of like tame down the activities of massacres and violence against our mob First Nations people here in this nation and this country. But what I would like to say is that yes, there was an incredible lot of violence against our mob, but unlike other memorial sites where there's a bit of angst and there's also a bit of name blame and pointing fingers and so forth, the Myall Creek Memorial Site, even though it's a massacre site, we try to move beyond the point of view of pointing fingers and rain vain, although that is certainly got its own place and right in the history of Australia and our shared history between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. But what happens is out there at Myall Creek, we try to move forward in hope and unity that we don't forget what's happened in the past, but we want to look to a future where we can all get along together, both Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people. When I say non-Aboriginal people, I also include not just white Australians, but also Middle Eastern, Asiatic people, East and West Europe, all of that sort of stuff, because of the fact that we are a polyglot of backgrounds and communities that right across this nation, and we come from all parts of the world. So when I say non-Aboriginal, I'm also inclusive to those. But I digest. And the Myall Creek massacre happened back in the 10th of June, 1838. 28 Wurundjeri people who were descendants of the Gamilaroi Nation were encamped with some hut keepers out at the Myall Creek Station, halfway between Inverell and Bingra, up here in the northwest. And that afternoon, about 5:30 in the afternoon, the mums, some of the older men, and certainly children and babies were just getting ready around the campfires to get ready to bed down for the night. When they heard riders approaching over the side of the ridge, the Wurundjeri had heard of some sort of like killings of people, Aboriginal people, further south, and they'd wanted to move further north to get away from all of that. So when they heard these riders coming, they started a panic, and about 28 of them rushed into one of the cabins. Now, luckily for these two young boys, there were two young boys that were standing nearby one of the hut keepers at the time, and they were going to run into the cabin as well, where the rest of the Wurundjeri were. But a chap, one of the hut keepers by the name of Anderson, put his arm out, and he locked the two boys, pushed them into the bushes. By doing that, he saved their life. If they got into that cabin, we wouldn't be talking about 28 Wurundjeri people that being massacred here. We wouldn't be talking about 30. So they carried out their dastardly deed. By circumstance, the fact that when they came over the hill, there was 11 riders, including the leader of them, which was attacked by the name of Fleming, who came out of the Hawkesbury. After they put some pressure on one of the leaders of the hut keepers, they continued through some of the other hut keepers and said, look, come and join us, be part of what we're going to do. And one of the hut people who'd been living and working alongside the Wurundjeri for the last 3.5 weeks prior to the event, for some unknown reason, he capitulated and said, yes, and he became the 12th man. They carried out their dastardly deed that afternoon, and the young Wurundjeri, that was about, I don't know, a dozen to 18 of them were away cutting bark. They'd heard that there was trouble back at Myall Creek, and they ran to get back there in time, but by then it was way too late. An investigation was carried out by a chap by the name of Edward Denny Day, who was a police magistrate. He was instructed by Governor Gipps, the Governor General at that time, to go up there and find out what had happened. Governor Gipps said, take any evidence you can, ask any interviews that you can, and make arrests as appropriate. And when they did, they brought back 11, because the leader of the troop got away into Queensland and didn't come back for at least another 30 years. We got away with a friend, scot-free. But the other 11 went to Sydney and underwent an initial trial, and this was conducted by the then Attorney General, John Plunkett. And now John Plunkett was a person of Irish extraction, and they themselves had already felt the angst of the British yoke of colonialism and the way that they treated people. So they had a sort of like a way of feeling towards Aboriginal people. It was a bit more amenable than other non-Aboriginal people at that time. And the Irish people said, okay, you know, the Aboriginal people are getting treated just the same way, if not more harsher than what the Irish were. So he had a vested interest to try and make sure the Aboriginal people saw justice. So the first trial, 11 people for the death of 28. At the end of that trial, after they'd brought evidence forward and they'd made testimonies and so forth, and the defence put up their argument, it was found by the jury that those 11 people were not guilty, as they had been charged, of killing 28 Wurundjeri. But rather than having them released from the stocks at that time, the magistrate turned around and said, hang on, this doesn't seem right to me. I don't like this in any regard at all. So the members that were in the stocks, of which there are 11, were rearrested and kept in the stocks. And the magistrate said to the Attorney General, John Plunkett, how do you wish to proceed from this point on? And John Plunkett said, well, we've already tried to go for the death of 28 at the hands of 11. I don't think we could go down that path anymore. So he said, I'm going to go for another trial, a second trial. But this time I'm going to go with 7 people for the death of 1. Now, the reason why he chose 7, because out of those 11 people, 7 of them he thought he had more opportunity to get a guilty verdict than not. And the death of 1, because remember that Edward Denny Day, the police magistrate that went up there to do the investigation, he brought back some evidence. And part of that evidence was the remains of a child, name unknown. And that was the evidence that was put up in the second trial to say, these 7 people caused the death of this one. Once again, a judicial process was put forward, and after a period of time of question and answering, defence put up, the prosecution put up, and so forth, the magistrate at that time turned around and said, all right, how does the jury find in this case? And the jury foreman, and this was where it gets interesting, because the jury foreman stood up and he said, we, the jury, find in the second trial that the 7 people engaged in the death of 1 are not guilty. And, of course, the people in the stocks thought, oh, this is great, we got away with it the second time. But a few seconds after the foreman had spoken those words, one of the jury people stood up and said, hang on, that's actually not correct. And the magistrate said to the jury foreman, sorry, can you explain what's going on here? And because the jury person that stood up had said, no, we've actually found them guilty. And when the jury foreman was questioned over this, it seemed that he wanted to put one past the court. And he said, and these are the words that he used, I apologise to the court, I misspoke. Well, another way of saying you've misspoke is that you lied. Okay? And it was then determined, yes, the actual jury did say that these 7 were guilty of the death of 1. And then after that, of course, they were summarily given their penalty, which was death by hanging at Hyde Park Barracks, which happened not long after that. Meanwhile, the Australian colony at that time, or the New South Wales colony at that time, was up in flames because after the community of the colony was saying, how dare white people be taken at task over the death of the black fellows, over the death of Aboriginal people? And the rest of the community was saying, yeah, it's about time someone looked after the interests of Aboriginal people. They've been treated very, very harshly over the, you know, since we came along and started, you know, taking control of the country, the environment and the colony.
Absolutely.
And it was sort of like arguments left, right and centre, and there was even writings in the paper about it. But this didn't just stop the massacre. The massacres continued way up until the 1920s, and in some cases it has been conjectured that it was right up into the 1930s.
All over Australia too.
All over Australia.
So
now, I had an interesting conversation with someone just recently where they said, but didn't Aboriginal people also kill white people? And we said, yes, they did. But let's look at the mathematics on this. There might have been the odd one or two acts of violence against white people during that colonising period, one or two, as opposed to thousands, literally thousands of instances where Aboriginal people were killed. Now, the thing is, a lot of these people that were killed after the Mile Creek Massacre of 1838, they said, oh, hang on, you know, these other fellows went to court and, you know, 7 of them were found guilty and they were summarily executed. We don't want to get that to happen to us. So they started to get a bit sneaky. All of a sudden, people just started disappearing in the night. Sometimes people's bodies would be found, you know, Aboriginal people, that is, and they'd be saying, all right, there's no evidence that they did it. Or sometimes flour was given to the Aboriginal people and replaced with poison, same with sugar and also sometimes spirits or wine. And these things happened summarily after that because the colonists said, we don't want to go to jail for killing blackfellas, so we're going to do this sneakily. And they did. And the thing is, the majority of the time they got away with it. The injustice of that was very poignant, very right in the face of everyone.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about Mile Creek. We want to make sure that that doesn't ever happen again. And that's why we've got the place like the Myall Creek Memorial, because we want to move forward in hope that we're not going to stick this in the past and say, oh, relegate it there and just remember it, but don't commemorate it. No,
exactly.
We on the Myall Creek National Committee, we make sure that that information is remembered, that those people that died on that day in 10th of June 1838 are remembered and they're respected because of the fact that they were killed summarily out of Ockham just because of the fact that they were black.
Uncle, you know what? This is not an interview. This is a yarn and a beautiful speech that you've given. But unfortunately now, it's been about 15 minutes and I've got to go to my next interview. But before we do, what are the dates for Myall Creek? And we will have to convene again and speak about other things.
Okay. Now, what we do is the June long weekend. Now, the commemoration itself is on the 10th of June. But that doesn't fall on the Sunday this year. Because what we do is we commemorate it all on the Sunday of that June long weekend. So we get together then. We have a pilgrimage from down at the bottom of near the Myall Creek at the hall. We walk up to the memorial site. We have a few speeches. Then we go through the memorial process, which takes about an hour and a half. Then we come back, a couple of more speeches, back down the bottom. And everyone feels suitably impressed by what we do out there at Myall Creek, but also saddened at the same time because they're learning something that's sort of sadness.
Absolutely.
But at the end of the day, we commemorate the fact that a lot of people come from all over the world, not just Australia, to respect and remember the deaths of the Wurundjeri people, 10th of June 1838.
Uncle, thank you so much for coming onto the program. It's so important. And we will talk very soon indeed.
Well, I'm on the road to Melbourne tonight, just after midnight. I'll probably be seeing you the next day or two, sweet.
I hope so. We're gonna make it happen.
Okay. All the best to your listeners out there. I hope they've learned something productive about my little interview today. But
you're
we
amazing.
Will talk again anyway.
We will. Thanks, Uncle. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Uncle Kelvin Brown speaking from Myall Creek Committee, speaking about the Myall Creek Massacre.
Sleepless Festival returns to Footscray this May, transforming Trugo Lane into a vibrant outdoor arts precinct. Across 3 days, May 15, 16 and 17, discover live music, performance, installations and visual art from emerging artists across Melbourne's west. With multiple stages, local food, bars and immersive art experiences, Sleepless invites you to gather, explore and share in Footscray's creative energy. Find the full program at sleeplessfestival.com, a 3CR supporter.
And you're listening to the Doin' Time Show, 3CR Community Radio. Australia's offshore processing regime should be dismantled due to corruption, neglect and irreparable harm, says the Human Rights Law Centre. There's an inquiry into offshore processing and resettlement arrangements, and they heard evidence from the centre regarding the harm that offshore processing has caused to thousands of people and their families over 13 years. The Albanese government knows that refugees sent to Nauru and Papua New Guinea have endured abuse, self-harm and neglect. Rather than dismantling this harmful regime, the government has expanded it. Now hundreds of people are facing deportation to Nauru on 30-year visas under a secret deal, many already suffering from life-threatening medical issues. I'm pleased to welcome Laura John, Associate Legal Director working on migration justice at the Human Rights Law Centre, to the Doin' Time Show to update us on this very, very important inquiry. Hello, Laura. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
Lovely to have you. And I think I've interviewed you before about
you
other
have
matters.
Indeed.
Yeah, in regards to asylum seekers. So, Laura, can you just begin by telling us a little bit about what's been going on in the background?
Sure. So we were in Canberra last Tuesday to give evidence to the Senate inquiry into offshore processing. And now this is a Senate inquiry that is examining in particular really serious corruption allegations about Australia's contracting arrangements with offshore countries such as Nauru and Papua New Guinea, for whom we've had arrangements to send asylum seekers and refugees. But really the key point of our evidence was to make sure the committee was aware of the really significant human impact of these policies. The corruption allegations must and should be properly investigated, but at the heart of this cruel policy is irreparable harm, and that should really be what drives long overdue change.
So when did this inquiry occur?
So this inquiry started several months ago after some explosive allegations about mismanagement of financial funds. Tuesday was the public hearing where a range of organisations, including our own, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, the Refugee Council of Australia, were able to go and give evidence in person to the committee. And the committee will publish a report on the 1st of June that will include a number of recommendations. We sincerely hope that one of those recommendations is that Australia's offshore processing regime should be dismantled.
Can you tell us a little bit about the recommendations?
So we have put to the committee that it should recommend the Australian government firstly dismantle the offshore processing regime in Nauru. Secondly, that it should ensure that every person who's been subjected to that regime is given permanent safety. And now that includes the 100 or so people who are currently trapped offshore in Nauru, the 26 people who've been abandoned by the Australian government in Papua New Guinea, and the roughly 700 people who are living in our communities in Australia who have survived offshore processing but remain in visa limbo with no pathway to permanent residency. And our third recommendation is that the government should, in addition, dismantle the expanded scheme that it has recently introduced for the deportation of people to Nauru. That is under new third country arrangements where people are being permanently exiled to Nauru on 30-year visas.
So it's quite a severe violation of human rights, isn't it?
It really is, and I think what is most shocking is that the harm that the offshore processing regime has caused is not unknown. It is already very well documented. 12 years ago, the very same Senate committee that we appeared before last week actually found that the Australian government had failed in its duty to protect people subjected to offshore processing in Papua New Guinea. 11 years ago, the government commissioned its own MOS review, which uncovered numerous incidents of sexual abuse and exploitation of women held in Nauru. And almost every year since, there have been reports, inquiries, investigations that have all concluded the same thing. This is a policy that does irreparable harm, and it's a policy that should have been dismantled a very long time ago.
So how can that happen?
It is a very good question. I think the government has, and successive Australian governments have, operated this regime under a veil of secrecy. And we all know that it is in those conditions that corruption and medical neglect and abuse are able to thrive. So I think that's been a really significant problem, particularly in the last few years, where this issue of offshore processing hasn't really been on the public's consciousness. And I hope that the inquiry is an opportunity for Australian people to understand what is being done in our name, with our money.
Indeed. And this was obviously an independent inquiry, correct?
It's actually an inquiry that is conducted by members of parliament who are members of the Senate committee. So we really hope that, each of those committee members will approach it with an objective mind and not be persuaded by party politics on this.
So the inquiry was launched after allegations of corruption and secrecy in Australia's offshore detention arrangements with Nauru, and that were reported in November 2025, is that right?
That's right. So we've had a number of whistleblowers who have come forward who have intimate knowledge of Australia's contracting arrangements, and they've been able to bravely come forward publicly to voice their concerns, and that is what has instigated this particular Senate inquiry.
The thing that blows my mind is that, you know, not only does everyone deserve to live in safety and with dignity, regardless of visa status, but instead, Laura, the Australian government has spent over $1 billion on offshore processing just to cause human suffering. Can you comment on that?
So our calculations show that this offshore processing policy has cost $13.35 billion since it was reintroduced back in 2012. that is an extraordinary amount of money. But as you say, what is significantly more than that is the human suffering that it's caused. We know that at least 14 people have died as a result of Australia's offshore processing regime. There have been a number of coronial inquests into some of those deaths that occurred in Australia, and they have overwhelmingly concluded that those deaths were preventable and would not have occurred if the person had received adequate medical treatment in Australia.
Absolutely. And in fact, I would encourage listeners to go onto the Human Rights Law Centre website and have a look at the media release and some of the quotes that are contained in that release. In particular, there's a woman who's a mother and a small business owner and refugee from Iran living in visa limbo. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, look, I am really proud that we are able to work with Masa, who has bravely told her story of surviving offshore processing and building a life here in Australia. Masa was actually 21 years old when she came to Australia with her mother in search of safety, and instead she was sent to Nauru, where she says she never felt safe. She came back to Australia for medical treatment and met her husband. They have two beautiful daughters who are 3 and 5 years old. And actually, just 2 weeks ago, Masa stood in the crowd and watched her husband and her children receive their Australian citizenship. Now, obviously, as a mother, she felt very happy and relieved that her daughters are finally secure in the only place that they have ever called home. But she is still left in limbo. And she's left in limbo because she has survived offshore processing and the Albanese government still won't provide her a pathway to permanent residency, even though the entirety of her immediate family are now Australian citizens. Now, that is something that must change. It's something that the minister has the power to change today. And we really urge the minister to start taking meaningful steps to grant permanent residency to these people who are stuck in this permanent limbo here in Australia.
So really it's twofold, because you've got people languishing at Nauru, you've got West Papua and other, you know, refugees, and then you've got the people here in Australia that are experiencing visa limbo.
That's exactly right. So we've got people who are in Nauru at the moment who are suffering, who are not being able to access adequate food or water, who have no certainty really about what the future holds for them. We've also got a small number of people who are still in Papua New Guinea, even though Australia has ceased its arrangements with PNG, who have been abandoned there by the Australian government. And then we've also got a group of about 700 people, like Masa, who are in Australia, have lived in our communities for a very long time, working, they're our neighbours, they're working in critical industries, they've raised families here, and they're just on rolling bridging visas. So every 6 months, Masa has to reapply for a short-term visa. That's the only visa that she's currently able to apply for, unless the Minister for Home Affairs intervenes and grants her a permanent visa.
Laura, following on from that, and, you know, there's quite a few quotes from refugees in the media release, which is great. The High Court dismissed a legal challenge, didn't it, to the Albanese government's power to permanently deport refugees and stateless people to Nauru. Are you able to comment on that, and, you know, the fact that there is inadequate medical care in Nauru?
Yes, that's right. So last Wednesday, the High Court handed down a decision in a case called TCXM. That case is not about offshore processing arrangements.
No.
It is about the new third country arrangements that Australia has entered into with the government of Nauru to essentially deport hundreds of people who have been living in our communities on a kind of one-way trip to Nauru. So they'll be granted 30-year visas. We don't know what happens after those 30 years. But this case that the High Court gave judgment on last week was about the Australian government's power to deport people under that new regime to a place where the government knows that people will face serious harm or even possibly death, because we know what the conditions are like in Nauru after over 13 years of the separate offshore processing scheme. Now, unfortunately, the High Court is constrained by applying orthodox legal principle and considering the Australian government's power under domestic laws. And the High Court concluded that the Australian government does have the power to deport people, even if they would face medical neglect there. But that certainly doesn't mean that the Australian government should do that. And we really think the government should take this as an opportunity to properly invest in people and people being able to rebuild their lives here in Australia with their communities.
Yeah, I mean, I realise this interview is about offshore processing, but I really felt I needed to connect the dots there and to actually have a look at the, you know, the what was happening with the health risks as well. But there are some excellent quotes here with asylum seekers and refugees. Just in conclusion, are you able to just give the Human Rights Law Centre website and direct listeners perhaps to some submissions about this topic?
Yeah, of course. So you can go to our website, which is hrlc.org.au. If you navigate to Migration Justice, you will see a whole series of resources from us and our team and the clients that we work with on offshore processing and also the new arrangements with Nauru for the deportation of people who have been living in our communities. In addition, if you're interested in learning more about the Senate inquiry, you can do a quick Google of Senate inquiry offshore processing, which will take you to the inquiry's homepage, and that actually includes a whole range of publicly available submissions from a variety of organisations. And we would really encourage listeners to take a look at the submission from our colleagues at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. They are in contact with most of the people who are in Nauru at the moment, and they have done a very significant health audit. And according to the data they've been able to provide, just in the last financial year, 93% of people who they are supporting in Nauru, refugees and asylum seekers, have physical health conditions, and 95% report serious mental health concerns. So that just gives you kind of a very bleak picture of the health crisis that people are facing in Nauru and the real urgency with which we need the government to act to dismantle this regime.
Laura, thank you so much for your very comprehensive discussion, and I'm hoping we can have you back on really soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your time.
Take care. Bye-bye. And that was Laura John, Associate Legal Director working on migration justice at the Human Rights Law Centre, updating us on the Senate inquiry, which heard renewed calls to dismantle offshore processing following evidence of abuse and corruption. And pretty soon we're going to be having Megan Schindler-Smith from People with Disability Australia, and I will have them on after a quick announcement.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
And you're listening to the Doin' Time Show, 3CR Community Radio. People with Disability backs Human Rights Commission President's call for National Human Rights Act. People with Disability Australia, the national advocacy and representative organisation led by and for people with disability, has backed President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Hugh de Kressner, call for a Human Rights Act made in an address to the National Press Club. Evidence provided by the Disability Royal Commission documented widespread experiences of violence, abuse, neglect and exclusion, and made clear that existing legal protections are not sufficient to prevent these harms or respond when they occur. PWDA agrees with the observations made that without enforceable rights, people with disability will continue to be exposed to harm with limited pathways to challenge it. I'm delighted to welcome Megan Schindler-Smith, Acting CEO of People with Disability Australia, to talk about this and much more. Hello, Megan. Welcome.
Hi, great to chat to you.
You too, you too. Megan, I'm wondering if you could talk about, I mean, it is actually quite horrifying what's happening to people with disability. I'm wondering if you could just talk about what happened and discuss with listeners really the implications of this act and how the backing came to be.
Yeah, look, it's so important because the fact is that we do not have a National Human Rights Act across Australia. So currently, yes, there are states and territories like Victoria and Queensland and the ACT that already have Human Rights Act. And, you know, it's great news that New South Wales is exploring a Human Rights Act. However, what that means is your access to your human rights and it being enshrined in law is dependent on your postcode. It's dependent on whether or not a specific jurisdiction is willing to meet that. And we know that the Disability Royal Commission demonstrated that the current protections are not preventing violence, abuse, and neglect, or even just exclusion experienced by people with disability. And if we don't make sure that there is a clear, defined way to enact and enforce human rights, including the UNCRPD, which looks at the rights for people like myself with disability, then that's going to continue to be repeated. And the damage is very high until we make sure that basic human rights are enshrined in law.
Absolutely. So the current system places the burden on individuals to pursue complaints through complex and often inaccessible processes. And I believe that PWDA has highlighted that in its submissions. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So currently what kind of happens is that you have to go through different specific laws like the DDA, which is the Disability Discrimination Act, which is a really important act, but it doesn't necessarily focus on ensuring that human rights are fully protected. Sometimes it can be a response process versus a preset, this is expected. And so, for instance, human rights protections matter because when systems fail, like the RoboDebt situation, it showed that harm can occur when governments make decisions without those proper safeguards, without that transparency, without those reviews. And we're starting to see some concerns emerging in disability systems, including around what's happening with the NDIS reforms, including around supported decision making, and especially around the importance of independent review, procedural fairness, and ensuring that there is human decision making in these safeguards. A Human Rights Act, a national one, would ensure, and it would reduce the impact because people with disability are disproportionately impacted by poverty, inaccessible housing, and barriers to employment. But a Human Rights Act would ensure a baseline is required.
Yeah, I'm wondering, and I know I did speak with other representatives from People with Disability Australia who also commented on prisoners and how the, you know, how that they're impacted. Were you able to briefly comment on that?
Look, absolutely. I mean, prisoners deserve the same level of human rights that anyone else in society have. But when there isn't that ability to ensure that their human rights are being met, then issues around access to safe healthcare, access to the education that they deserve, but also access to the basic needs within the prison system to ensure that they're able to get access to the right lawyers or actually being able to even access the information to know what their rights are and aren't is not being easily supported without having a strong human rights approach that underlies everything we do.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I'm just having a look at the media release as well, and it's so, there's so many risks here. I mean, even in terms of current NDIS reforms, and what's quite appalling here, what I'm seeing here in the context of the NDIS new framework planning, the Minister for Health, Disability and Ageing, Mark Butler, has not guaranteed human decision-making or access to independent appeal rights in all cases.
And that's the key, is that a Human Rights Act would ensure that those safeguards are not just an expectation, they're a basic right that everyone has. And it's absolutely important that people with disability not just have the option, but have the absolute right to question decisions that have been made that affect their basic access to life, to community, to having the same dignity and autonomy and opportunities as everyone else. So it's not about special rights, it's about actually ensuring that we can question a decision that's been made on our behalf and can be part of that discussion.
Yeah, interestingly, it's all about lived experience, and the Do and Time show provides a safe environment for people with lived experience and from marginalised communities, including people with disability and also First Nations communities and people in prison, to come and talk about what affects them. And we urgently need a Human Rights Act.
We do. And the fact is that we know that basic access to housing, to employment, to support from the government that ensure that you can be part of the socioeconomic system are the barriers that stop people having to go into justice systems. So how do we make sure that we're not over-policing or creating problems that actually mean that the justice system becomes an option for them that it should never have been because their basic rights weren't met? So how do we make sure that we are actually ensuring that the CRPD is actually reflected in our Australian laws fully?
Exactly. And actually, I wanted to ask you this, Megan. You may have heard over the weekend that there's been a win in the by-election in New South Wales of One Nation Party. Can you comment on that?
Look, I had heard a little bit about this, and obviously it is a sign that for some of our community, they are representing what they're looking for, which is not always representative of what we need from a disability community perspective, and it's not always representative of what we need from an inclusive society perspective. And so, realistically speaking, it is a sign that people are looking for support in alternative ways because they need to know that they can enforce their rights in some way, and that is one of the pathways people are choosing. I don't necessarily want to agree or disagree. But
No. My point, Megan, is not to discuss politics, because I know people with disability are often used as political footballs, but more about, you know, to make sure that there isn't racism. That, you know, we need to also be mindful about, you know, the One Nation Party is very much against migration and against difference. And people with disability are not immune to being excluded, because an injury to one is an injury to all. So if migrants can be stopped from, you know, coming to our shores because of Trump-like policies, then in the same manner, people with disabilities can also be excluded because fascism is alive and well.
And what we know is the fact is that an inclusive society ensures that there isn't racism, there isn't ableism, that there is actually right to be the diverse and inclusive people that we need. And what that actually brings to our society is so much more than any concerns that people are trying to put forward. It is so important that we have equity and we have access to basic human rights. And that impacts the whole community. No one is truly immune, and human rights are basic for every person. It's not just for diverse communities. It's for every community, but diverse communities are the ones that get impacted first and the most.
Absolutely. And in conclusion, final question. So PWDA has called on the federal government to use the upcoming budget to lift income support. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, look, we absolutely have. We're part of two things. One, we've been part of the ACOS raise the rate around making sure that we actually have viable and actually economically stable funding for supports, but also from a disability support pension. We need to recognise that for people with disability, it is highly cost impactful to be a person with disability and access the supports we need. And only a small percentage of people with disability are on the NDIS or have access to that additional support. So we need to make sure that we're not putting communities backwards because they're not getting access to their basic human rights through economic sustainability. And so that's one of our big calls, absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, a Human Rights Act, I'm sure you would agree here, would provide a clear, enforceable framework to guide these decisions and must reflect Australia's international obligations.
Absolutely.
Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. Look, any Human Rights Act would expressively incorporate CRPD rights, and we have signed up to that at an international level. We should be living by that. The fact is that the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability recognises that people with disability are rights holders. We're not objects of charity or welfare, and we should be part of every decision that impacts us directly. And that's where we get that accountability, and we make sure we have the right to say that was wrong, and we can hold our government and our community to accord in that space.
And that would be under the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Is that right?
Absolutely. You're exactly right, yes.
Megan, thank you so much for coming onto the program, and certainly, you know, 3CR is Radical Radio, and actually our Radiothon is coming up, and we need to raise money for so that people from, you know, marginalised communities can come onto the show. But what I want to say to you is this: these questions that I'm asking you were in no way meant to be confrontational. But look, we have to be confrontational in some ways, don't we, to get what we want?
Sometimes we have to speak up and we have to speak out. We don't have to damage other people by doing it.
Of course not.
But we can absolutely stand up for our rights and say, this is not correct. You should not be acting in this way towards us. We have a right to the same level of humanity that everyone else does.
Thanks so much, Megan. I was very happy and honoured to have you on the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's wonderful to chat.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
And that was Megan Schindler-Smith, Acting CEO of People with Disability Australia, speaking about the fact that Australia needs a Human Rights Act, basically. It's approximately 4:49, and I'm going to see if I can put a song on.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
The 3CR Radiothon kicks off in June. To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 9419 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Again, none of them making a sound again, cause I'm up. All of my titters get down, none of them bringing us down again. None of us front, we got many men.
How we up? All my titters to the front, straight up on them, bust it up. What the argue for the walls, peak box in the cut, tell them all to go jump. Ooh. This four little mob is box in the mix, I'ma do what I want. Do it, stood in this game and I still real ruthless. Got the haters, I live them more toothless. Stuck on computers like, what is he stupid? I like, what is he stupid? Hate to be hating on sisters who do this. But pricky was useless, never take food from a tree that is fruitless. Since they dodged, I said for my titters. Said I get clean and prick, I did it. Underdog and I'm ten toes with it. Sleep on planes, no rest for the wicked. Ha ha, I'm off. Hustling like I'm Rick Ross. Another day for the boss. Trying to book in, shit, just up the cost. Nobody bringing me down, nobody bringing me down again. None of them making a sound again, cause I'm up. All of my titters get down, none of them bringing us down again. None of us front, we got many men.
How we up? All my titters to the front, straight up on them, bust it up. What the argue for the walls, big box in the cut, tell them all to go jump. Ooh. This four little mob is box in the mix, I'ma do what I want.
Do we got a problem? Well, I am the woman to solve it. You men playing up on your sis. Well, I'ma tell Titus to ghost him. Huck him. He think he good, but he nothing. Think he count, he's like he starts forgetting bad dogs. Cause it'd be hard, cause butter he ugly. Huck him all. Stood my ground and I'm back for talk. Maybe you should go best yourself. Cause you vest me, you gon' lose it all. I'm just saying, bro, I ain't playing, bro. I walked in, but still, I done ate it up. Man's ego got them big titties. So I told that boy to go fill my cup.
I'm up. Nobody bringing me down, nobody bringing me down again. None of them making a sound again, cause I'm up. All of my titters get down, none of them bringing us down again. None of us front, we got many men.
How we up? All my titters to the front, straight up on them, bust it up. What the argue for the walls, big box in the cut, tell them all to go jump. Ooh. This four little mob is box in the mix, I'ma do what I want.
And you're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, with Marissa on the Doin' Time show. And it's approximately 4:53, and you just heard a song. I've never heard that song before. It's pretty cool, actually, by Barker, and the song is called We Up. Yeah, and we can't let anyone let us bring us down. So I wanted to thank all our guests for coming onto the show. Thank you to Uncle Kelvin, and also thank you to Laura John from the Human Rights Law Centre, and also to Megan Schindler-Smith from People with Disability Australia. And we discussed a range of topics in the lead up to, and it's that time of year, Radiothon is coming up, and it's happening in June. The theme is the 50-year celebration. Please start donating to all shows at 3CR. The target for the Do In Time show is $1,000, and we need to raise that to keep 3CR on air. So, yeah, the donations are tax deductible. Start calling 94198377 to donate to Do In Time and all shows at 3CR. It's approximately 4:55, and pretty soon we're going to be nearing the end of our show and going out with our theme song, Black Fella, White Fella by the Rumpy Band. And thank you once again to all our contributors today on the show. And wanted to also give a shout out to everybody, but also to Uncle Kelvin, who spoke about the Mile Creek massacres. And the Do In Time show is very much always going back to colonisation and building the movement to stop Aboriginal deaths in custody, and also reaching out also to asylum seekers and refugees, who are also an integral part of this show. And, of course, a shout out to our brothers and sisters inside as well. We've got about 1 minute before I'm out of here. So goodbye from Marissa. Take care of each other. Bye.
As long as you a true fella, as long as you a real fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter what your name is, we got to have lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we're shouting? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan? Black fella, white fella, yeah.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.